I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
They want chase scenes and car crashes.
They want the cops to bend the rules to get the job done. They want the boy to get the girl. They want the good guy to win. They want the bad guy to die, hopefully in the biggest explosion the budget will allow. But most importantly, Senator, they want to walk into a theater and for 90 minutes forget the fucking mess that you have left of this nation.
Go get your bubblegum.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Hello and welcome back to All Out of Bubblegum, the podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the 80s horror cult classic film, The Hitcher. Today we have with us Brandon and Marty.
Hello.
Hello.
And how are we feeling about The Hitcher?
And its sequel, we should mention.
Yeah, and we'll probably bring up the she-make, as I call it. It's when it's a remake where they just gender swap, usually the main character.
That's one of the things they sort of do, yeah. Though, to be fair, the sequel did the exact same thing.
But kinda.
It's much greater effect.
Yeah, it plays more as a sequel, though, because you have the returning main character. So
yes.
But yeah, how are we feeling about the original film?
I hadn't seen it in ages. By now, I've watched 100 of Rutger Hauer's movies. So I was keen to go back to it. And I gotta say, I loved it. Absolutely loved it this time. Maybe, probably my favorite film he ever did.
Ooh, better than Blade Runner?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Really? Okay. So I actually... It's up there. I having rewatched it for this, I thought it was I give it like a perfect score because it's so well done. But it's also he's so effectively used.
Yes.
Only after I watched this did I find out they originally wanted Sam Elliott, which I think would have been a really cool choice too.
Yeah.
But they played it so like I cannot imagine Elliott playing it this way. Like he makes very interesting choices.
Oh, yeah. That's one thing that maybe I'll say a lot, that this movie and its remake both made a lot of choices, especially when you compare the two, and one of them made all the right choices, and the other one showed why that were the right choices, because it made all the wrong choices.
I think the thing that stands out about this movie to me is not even... I mean, it's just vibes. The whole movie it's great. Like vibes of this movie are really cool, but also the cinematography. I had forgotten how well shot this movie is. This is probably the best shot movie of the entire 80s. It's so well shot.
It's gorgeous.
Like, it's not the most beautiful images. Like, I think Blade Runner is a gorgeous movie and a gorgeous Rutger Hauer movie, but this movie, I'm like, wow, it's fucking incredible. Every other shot, I'm like, whoa. Look what they're doing here. Look he goes in when he gets arrested, he's going into the jail cell. The way he's allowing the lighting to come in the windows. And I was like, that's great. There's a great shot where he hides on the bus and it leaves. And then it's this really far distant shot of the bus leaving. And it just lingers long enough for you to see, oh, there's that black pickup truck following.
Yeah.
Like, that's awesome.
Yes.
It's constant stuff and zooms and sweeps and sudden like crane movements that you did not expect. It's great.
Yeah. The DP of this film is Oscar winner John Seale, who recently did Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, this guy. You get the, the dude's definitely from that Australian school and you feel it through much of the movie.
Yes.
So that makes sense to me.
Okay, going back to the vibes of the film. It does feel like a dream or a nightmare at times, especially during that like iconic scene where the female lead is like tied up between like two trucks and she's about to be ripped in two. It just feels like a nightmare, just the way it feels. It's very oniric. You're like in a trance watching it. And that's probably the best part of the movie for me, is just the general feel of it, like the nightmarish feel, like you're transported into somebody's dream.
Yeah. Well, it operates on a kind of dream logic.
Definitely.
There's like a level of, you know, is this... You know, is he a supernatural being? Like, this kind of, like, what is happening through most of the movie? You're just like, what? What? But it's, like, terrifying. I caught this movie on cable many, many years ago. It was just, like, you know, the stay up all night kind of thing and what's on. And I'm watching the movie and I was, like, transfixed. And seeing this in widescreen on a Blu-ray, which I had not seen this movie in many years, and seeing it just looking as gorgeous as it could is a whole different experience, and I loved watching it again.
Oh yeah, I'm jealous you got to watch this on Blu-ray.
Supposedly there's a nicer version coming out, I think this year.
No, like a 4K or just a better Blu-ray?
Maybe both.
Oh, that should be interesting. Yeah, maybe we should go back to even before The Hitcher.
You talk about China Lake.
Did you watch China Lake, Brendan?
I did not see it.
Oh, I did.
Yeah, and it seems almost preordained that Robert Harmon would go on to direct The Hitcher after you've seen China Lake.
Okay.
So China Lake is a kind of... it's like a spiritual predecessor. It's about a half hour long, and it's about a cop played by Charles Napier who is just kind of going around, kind of horrifyingly abusing his authority.
On his holiday.
Yeah, he's on vacation.
Wow.
But he's riding a motorcycle around the desert in his suit or his uniform, and he's just doing stuff. You know, he's locking people in trunks and driving their car, or he drives one guy's car off into the desert, and then he's like, you know, stealing gasoline. It's just like, you're like, what is this guy's deal? And the thing that's really creepy about it, at least for me, is the ending. It's him back at work the next day, pretty much, and they're like, hey, how was your vacation? He was like, it was great.
For him, it was great.
I was like, there's like a meme on the internet, which is it's a cop. I'm not sure what it's from. Kind of looks like a King of the Hill screen or something. And the cop's just like, what a glorious day to abuse my authority or something along those lines. And that's the entire movie.
Yeah. Because it also has the scene at the diner where he isn't in uniform and he only fantasizes about fucking people up.
Oh, yeah.
And then later he actually does it when he has his uniform on.
Yeah, it's just like, that's what he's thinking about. And that's why I think the ending is so freaky to me. Because you're like, oh, this guy just went back to work to do the same thing he did on his vacation, you know?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, man, that's deep.
The vibes are there. Plus, there's like a synth score that's very similar. And so you're just like, oh, it's just like terrifying. I think it's maybe even a little bit more terrifying because this is a man in authority who can just do whatever he wants, it seems. Yeah. Whereas in The Hitcher, it's just a hitchhiker who seems uncatchable and unstoppable and just keeps popping up and tormenting a soul man. So.
Which is the movie that C. Thomas Howell did after The Hitcher because he wanted to get far away from the movie.
Oh, he didn't
like it. He considers it one of his best, but it's also a dark movie.
Oh.
And I think Soul Man is the one where he has blackface, right?
Yes.
Brendan will love it. Oh. No.
So I really like C. Thomas Howell in this. He's unrecognizable when we watched him in Gettysburg with the big old bushy mustache.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I mean, he's in a lot of stuff, notable stuff. You know, he was in E.T. and The Outsiders, but you probably, maybe, like, I knew him myself more from, like, Red Dawn.
Yes.
Like, oh, he's one of the kids from Red Dawn.
Yeah, star of The Sweeper that Stein and I have gushed over before on the podcast. He's a classic PM Entertainment actioner from, I think, the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah, and Robert Harmon and Eric Redd, the screenwriter, constantly refer to him as Tommy Howell on the audio commentary. So I guess I'll be doing the same from now on.
Yeah, why not? Because what's C, you know?
Yeah.
Apparently it's like Christopher or something, but he was like, I'm not going to be Chris Howell.
No.
Make it a weirder name. But I will call him Tommy because that's who he played in Gettysburg.
Yeah, so, yeah, Tom Chamberlain.
Tommy C.
And the third main actor really in this movie is of course Jennifer Jason Leigh, who also shows up in Rutger Hauer's second best movie, Flesh and Blood.
Oh, I love Flesh and Blood.
Classic Verhoeven.
I got a nice blue of that too.
Ooh.
But yeah, it's aside from being a really well shot movie, there's a ton of great stunts in this movie, just vehicle stunts.
Oh yeah,
the cars flipping where they do the explosion underneath the car that makes them flip. The first time they ever did that stunt was in the movie McHugh, John Wayne film. But they did that same stunt, and it's very impressive because it's two cars.
But you say explosion, but you mean like air-powered piston?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or air-powered. They shoot it out with high-pressure air.
there was a like a stunt feature that used to play before the movies when I was I think when I was in my 20s. I think it was J.J. Perry would be on there, and he'd always be talking about how they did this stunt. Well, they flip in the guy. He would say, "There literally is a bomb underneath the car." That's how he would say it every time. I was like, "Okay, dude." But in the behind the scenes for, I think, The Dark Knight, they describe it as a piston that shoots down into the road.
Yeah, that's where I first heard it.
Yeah,
you can clearly see them in the Hitcher as well.
Yeah, you can actually
see the double barrel roll.
Yep, because it's slow motion. You get a good look at it, and it's right in your face.
Yeah. But, you know, that just means that they did it for real.
Well, then they also do the great bit where the helicopter drops out of the sky and that explodes, and then a car crashes through that and it's on fire and that flips over.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff. It looks brilliant on film.
The helicopter, by the way, was dropped from another helicopter.
Wow.
Oh, okay. I was wondering how they did that.
They had a bigger helicopter and then this one hung from that by cables and they just dropped it.
That's cool.
And supposedly, funny anecdote from the audio commentary, one of the producers went up to Robert Harmon and said, "Okay, but like, what if it fails? What do we do then? Because we only have one helicopter." And he was like, "Oh, it's fine. We'll go to plan B." And the producer was, "Okay, cool." And he walked off. But there was no plan B. And this was really just a one-take thing.
Well, he also had a, when they flipped the cars, and you see that in the footage, the beginning of it is shot from behind. And it's because they had two cameras going on a separate truck on the back. And the idea was to move, like, there's a guy operating a smaller crane off this truck.
Yeah.
And it was, as he slams on the brakes, as the cops shoot each other, basically, the camera was going to start low and then bounce up above the car as it slammed the brakes. It was going to go over the roof and then go back down and have a nice close-up along the road of these cars flipping from the back. Yeah. But the car started flipping in the wrong way, basically, and it would have killed everybody on this truck, so the stunt driver basically went off the road and it ruined the shot from that angle. But the director and I think half the camera crew, including John Seal, was on that truck, and they would have all died if he hadn't done that. So yeah. They're like, okay.
So did they do it again? Do you know?
No. They just used the other shots, the other angles.
Okay, yeah, because I think John Seal said he had like 8 or 9 cameras going at the same time.
Yeah, and you know what? It looks great, so whatever.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's one of the best filmed car crashes I've ever seen, actually.
Oh.
In the script for Long Kiss Goodnight, it's one of my favorite written scripts I've ever read. He says, imagine God throwing dice down a crab's table, but instead of dice, their cars, and they're on fire. And that's, I always think of that. I'm like, what a cool line, the way he wrote that, you know, a car crash. I was like, it's beautiful. And then you watch this movie and you're like, that's what that looks like when those cars are just flipping down the road. You're like, that's like, they're like dice getting rolled down the, you know, like, that's just cool.
Yeah,
it's probably one of the coolest scenes. And that's one of the reasons I don't like the remake, is they do this similarly. But then they make the Hitcher, he's played by Sean Bean, he's driving a black Trans Am and he's shooting a cool gun and got 9-inch nails playing. And I'm just like, I hate this. When you make something like obviously cool, like, it's so hard to just be wrong. And that's what that movie does with that scene.
Yeah.
I hate it.
And the music choice is one of the worst choices in that movie.
Well, yeah. So much has been made of the, as I like to say, the pseudo-homosexual threat of Rutger Hauer's character to Tommy Howell there.
Yeah.
And when you make it obvious by playing I Want to Fuck You Like an Animal over it.
And by making one of the characters a woman.
Yeah, you've already changed the dynamic. And now you're making it like it's just too on the nose. Yeah. So that's my issue there. I love Sean Bean, actually, and I like most of the actors in the movie, but I hate how they do almost everything in that film.
Yeah. Had it not been a remake of The Hitcher, it would have been a perfectly fine movie.
Yeah, yeah. Also, it's like it's one of those, as they say, pointless remakes where, yes, you know, people yell about Psycho and stuff, where you're just like, they do almost the exact same thing, all the exact same shots. Like, why do we do this? And, you know, they don't do anything better I would say, with the exception of the scene in this film where Jennifer Jason Leigh is tied between the two trucks. And this is subjective for sure. You do see the love interest type character, whatever you want to call them, like ripped in half in the remake. You do see it. Whereas in this one, there's a fade out and it's just in your head. In fact, this movie's implied violence, for me, it works really well, especially when he's talking about cutting the guy's legs off, his arms and his head. I remember the first time I saw this, I was like, oh my God, I feel like I saw it, but I know I didn't. Whereas in the remake, they're not shy about like showing you things.
Yeah,
I was kind of surprised how much implied violence there was in this film. I mean, it earns its R rating. Yes, it does, but it's not in your face with the gore as it could have been. There's a lot of things that are left unseen, and some of the squib work, while very bloody, not as quite as gory as it could have been. I was kind of surprised, but it's still a good movie, yes.
Yeah, this movie plants itself firmly as a like a surreal thriller and not as a, some kind of like gore fest, which I think a lot of people probably wrongly thought it was when it came out.
Yeah, like I think Roger Ebert was down on this film because of the violence level, but there isn't that much gore in the film.
And honestly, I think that means that they did a good job. When you can make the audience think that they saw something way worse than what actually was there. You know, it's the old Hitchcock Psycho trick where you're like, oh man, I think that it's so gory and it's so brutal. And then, you know, you go back and you watch it, you're like, technically not.
Yeah.
We might be underselling the movie's gore a little bit, but yes, most of it is off screen.
Yeah. I mean, he literally kills a family full of, or a car full, like that's filled with kids and a mom and pop. And you don't see it, but it's like under, it's implied. And you're like, wow, you don't even know what he saw. You see blood drips down from a car. Like that's all you see. You see a couple of blood drops down onto his shoe. Like that's the kind of thing where you're like, wow, they did a fantastic job because you don't see it. But you're like, oh my God, it must be horrible.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Howell is so good in this. His reactions to everything are so good.
Oh yeah.
There's a fucking fantastic scene, which I just do not see anybody doing now or then, or even, I don't even remember this in the remake, where he, after the two cops are killed, and he goes out and he contemplates killing himself just to end the nightmare. And I was like, that's fantastic. And it's not even dialogue. This entire sequence is like, oh, you're so on the wavelength. And that's how well the movie does. This is part of the vibes. That you understand what he's doing, what he's thinking, what he's going through. Oh, it's so good.
And then the sun comes out.
Yeah.
Which was completely by accident, and Howell just kept going with the scene. Fantastic moment.
Well, that's, again, that's something that's like, today everything's so planned, and I feel like they would be like, you know, the scene was ruined because of the cloud cover or something, and they would have like reshot it, and it would have looked way better, but like in a technical sense, but in a literal sense it'll be way worse because this felt natural.
Yeah.
So just goes to show that the instincts sometimes of a director and a cinematographer and an actor can be just really on the same level and just really bring out something special. And I think that like that scene is exemplary for that.
Yeah. I think if maybe we should just go over the plot.
Yeah.
So it starts, see Thomas Howell, or Tommy Howell, delivering a car, I guess, across the state of Texas.
Yeah, they call it a driveway or something like that.
Yeah.
Which must be a thing. I've never heard of it.
But yeah, me neither.
Even though I've had people deliver vehicles to me, so.
How did this get here?
Yeah. So it must be like that. I don't know. But anyhow.
Yeah, so he does that, and like immediately, 4 minutes in, he picks up Rutger Hauer as a hitcher. And then also like immediately becomes clear that this guy is a psycho killer. This thing just hits the ground running. No setup, no nothing, just immediately cut to the chase.
Yeah, it's one of the film's strengths, I think, is that it never wastes your fucking time.
No. And he's just clearly psycho from the beginning, where it's, again, in the remake, they don't pick him up. And the entire movie feels like he's just trying to get to them because they didn't pick him up.
Yeah.
Which is just really weird.
Well, it's especially weird when you look at it like it's shorter. It's a shorter movie. So you're like, you could be a leaner version of this movie, which sounds crazy. You're like, how would they even do that? And the answer is they apparently couldn't. yeah, they just waste your time a little bit. The way they do it is they make it a little cooler, a little more slick. I mean, the remake's a Platinum Dunes production. Yeah. So, I mean, that's really all you need to know.
Yeah. And I liked Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake they did.
I know a few people that do, and I say, fuck that. Actually, I'll be honest. I don't hate it. I just think that Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a film that you can never remake. You can't, like, reproduce, I guess I should say. Like, it does something on its own that no one else will ever be able to do the same way. It's like Blair Witch Project, where there's a million different found footage movies, but they're never going to quite be what that movie was. So, yeah. I think you could probably remake The Hitcher. I just have trouble believing you could do it as well. And the remake is exhibit A of that.
Yeah. The remake also seems to go for a faux 70s vibe.
Yeah.
Because of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, I think.
Yeah.
And it's also weird. Like, the car they drive, the clothes they wear, you're like, oh, is this the 70s? But no, it isn't. Why is that? Why did you put that in there?
It's also, you know, as I said, it's Platinum Dunes got a problem in that they make everything look too good. Part of the appeal of Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that it is a grimy, dirty movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, the movie, like, it, like, almost reeks. And you're just watching it and you're just going, ugh, you know. Which, this movie is, there's nothing like that. This movie's like...
Gorgeous, is, beautifully shot.
Yeah, if you go watch, you're just weird to, like, compare it to, but it's like, go watch Raising Arizona. It's the only movie that, like, the camera is moving in maybe a similar fashion. But, you know, I don't know. It's just like that kind of look with the zooms and the sudden handhelds. And then it'll be like, oh, no, this shot where they're running around this tower and then they're going to run over to the truck stop. Oh, no, now it's a crane shot. You're like, yeah, I didn't know that it was going to do that. You know, this stuff like that. It's just like, oh, it's a delightful surprise every other moment with the camera work.
Yeah. But Tommy Howell manages to kick Howard out of his car. And then Howard just keeps on tormenting him. I still don't know if he does it deliberately, but he gets Tommy Howell framed for all the killing he does.
Yeah. Well, that's where, like, the movie enters absolute nightmare mode.
Yeah.
Where it's like this paranoid thriller suddenly.
Yes. Also, what I like is that they sort of plant the idea in your mind that John Ryder, the Hitcher, is all in Tommy Howell's head, but they never have the character say out loud, was it me? Or something like that.
Yeah, well,
you only know it if you think about it yourself.
When he sits down with him at the diner, I think the first time I watched this movie, I was still like, is he real? You know, when he pulls the trigger of the gun and it doesn't, you know, go off. And then he's like, why are you doing this? He's like, you're a smart boy. You'll, you know, figure it out or whatever. And it's like, is he in his fucking head?
Yeah.
Also, just like, what the fuck is he doing there? Like, what do you think the metaphor is? Like, I was like, is he like Karen on the River Styx? You know, like that he puts the pennies in his eyelids. And it's like, what a thing to do. It's so weird.
Yeah. But I was asking myself that question throughout the entire movie. Because there's some obvious gay subtext introduced, like, almost right away. Like, is that what he's supposed to represent in some way? But then, no, probably not. Just, you could read so many things into this movie. We would be here for quite a while if we went through all of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely there. Like, that's the thing. I can see, like, Sam Elliott, if he would have played this, I can see him just being, like, a dark, like, cowboy figure. Like, you're like, what is this? And he could do it. He's got that big, the booming voice. He's got, he has an intensity with his eyes. He would have sat there and, you know, you're a smart boy. Figure it out. You know, it would have been interesting. But Howard just brings, like, that intensity, especially when he has, like, a, you know, he's a good-looking guy. So you're like, oh, what is his deal? And then at the end of the movie, even when he's like caressing his hair with the gun,
yeah,
you're like, what, like, something has transpired here between these two characters, like, you know, that you can never really understand. And maybe there's like a gay subtext there, but it, I don't know, it's like this whole other thing.
Yeah, the way Howard looks at Howell, it seems like he's constantly trying to look into him,
yeah,
like, trying to get a read or something. So well, much happening.
The first time he's looking at him, my impression is like a, it's like he looks at him like prey. And then there's like a there is a point where he starts like, oh, I need to get something out of him. And it's really interesting. And that whole bit where he says he wants him to say, I want to die, which is that fantastic when he kicks him out and he, you know, he's like, I want to live. And just fantastic. This is like, it's like two philosophies of existence clashing. And it's like, oh, he's like interested. He becomes immediately interested, and there's a great shot where the camera just flies down the road and as Rutger Hauer gets up and it's just looking like up his jaw, almost like it's like under his knees somehow. It's that shit is like, oh, like what a cool shot without being fucking cool, you know? It's like, wow.
But Harmon actually pointed that shot out specifically on the commentary track.
Okay.
As an example of the weather just being perfect, because you can see like the storm front coming in the background, the dark clouds.
Yeah.
It's like, imagine this shot with clear blue sky. It wouldn't work.
Like, so, what I agree. What a thing. Upon rewatch, I started thinking these things though. Like, he might have died, Howell's character, because he's falling asleep when he's driving. Like, did he crash, you know, headlong into that truck? Or, you know, it's like, what is going on? And make the movie's just in his head. Is this all a dream?
Is him fighting for his life?
Yeah.
Like, in the hospital?
Or even, like, he's imagining the entire scenario. I don't know. It's like, there's a, you know, to keep himself awake. I don't know. There's just so much weirdness there.
Yeah, but that's what I sort of referred to earlier. Is you could read so much into this movie without the movie asking you to, because the cinematic language we're used to is you see somebody fall asleep, have a near-death experience. That usually means this and this.
Yeah.
Like that everything that comes after could be imagined or whatever. Though the movie never says it might be. It does use the cinematic language that we have in the back of our minds.
Yeah. And so you're just like, any number of things could be true, which is why this movie absolutely rules. Because you can like kind of, you know, take out whatever you put in. You're like, yeah, that sounds right to me.
Yeah.
What is your current theory, though?
I don't think I have a theory. I just like that there's so many possible ones and that it's just kind of ambiguous. Like, I enjoy that, too.
I'm in the same boat. Okay. I'm not a big theorizer when it comes to movies. I just kind of, like, take them as they are. And that's where I'm at, you know? I mean, it could be anything. It's very dreamlike, nightmarish. And that's just what it is. It could be anything. And it's fun to read the theories, but I'll just take it at face value for now.
Oh, I love to theorize, but I'm also fine with not having one theory that I believe in.
Oh, okay.
What is your take on why he wants Tommy Howell to kill him so much?
I don't know. You can see a sort of respect for him after he kicks him out of the car. Like the way John Ryder just looks at the car driving off. He's like, I've met my match and I'm going to play this till the end. Sort of. He's trying to push him to something, to do something. He's almost like the Joker in The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Who just wants Batman to kill him.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, but you are right. He is like honing in on like C. Thomas Howell in the same way the Joker does to Batman. I never thought about that.
And actually, Robert Harmon said one of the very few things they changed in the script was in the I Want to Die scene. They have John Ryder say I Want to Die to C. Thomas Howell twice. So he says, say I Want to Die. And then Jim Halsey, the character, says, what? And then he repeats, say I Want to Die. And originally he only said it once, but Harmon explained they had to have him say it twice, once for himself and one for Halsey. So there's also the idea that John Ryder is the one who actually wants to die, but he wants to die by the hand of somebody who he deems worthy. Just another one of those crazy theories.
Yeah. I like the idea that he is ultimately a force for good, even though he is basically pure evil.
Yes.
And that by committing evil, he will find pure good. And that's what he does. The other thing that's great about this movie is that if you watch this for the first time, I don't think there's really anything to tell you where it's going to go. Like every scene, you're like, I have no idea how this is going to play out. The closest it gets is when John Ryder first gets into the car, you see that insert of the indicator saying door ajar. And that tells you that he could kick him out of the car. He could. So there's that. But every other scene, you're like, I have no idea where this is going to go. You know, when he shows up and he shoots down the helicopter and he and all that happens, it's a complete fucking surprise. And yeah. You're left like Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, just like staring like, oh my God, what is happening?
Yeah. But that is in part also due to the structure, because yeah. It starts right away. You're like, if this is the start of the movie, where the fuck can it go? You're expecting something more with the structure of the remake.
Yeah.
It sort of introduces characters, builds up, la-di-da, all that stuff. But no, this one just builds completely different.
The remake does a thing that I hate, which is my problem with a lot of modern movies, is that they funnel everything into a three-act structure, whereas this movie, the structure is all over the place. You're like, I don't know. It's really a two-act movie. So You're like, when he's in his car, and then when he loses the car, and everything else is going on.
Well, the screenwriter Eric Red does talk about the acts in the movie on the audio commentary track. Oh. But it might just be better hidden, I think. Like, the beats aren't your typical three-act structure Hollywood movie beat.
Yeah.
Because he clearly mentions the scene where Halsey is interrogated by the cops. It happens at, I think, like 32-minute mark as the start of the second act.
Okay.
He's now being framed for it, end of first act, start of second act.
As I look at it, the characters are not introduced to us so much as they are revealed over the course of the film. So there's not, like, the remake does this whole introduction, so we know who they are and what's at stake pretty much right away. Whereas this is like, it's way more abstract. He gains a kind of relationship with the Jennifer Jason Leigh character, but not really. This is like a lone person. He didn't come in like, oh, I'm meeting my bride-to-be or something, you know, or I just got fired and now I'm doing this. You don't know what's going on. The weird characters are all over the place.
And it also plays with our expectations of introducing a female character at this point in the movie. It just does something completely different.
Yeah. I'm guessing that they originally had a whole love scene and stuff because there's definitely like, you can feel the temptation of that scene and you're almost like, oh, I'm gonna hate this. It's going to make no sense. They're just going to do this. And then they don't. They don't do it.
In the original script, they did have sex.
Okay.
Just before, when they're in the motel, when he's in the shower after she's watching the movie and Howard goes into bed with her. At that point in the original script, they did have sex.
Well, I'm glad they didn't do it.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, and I'm not one of the people that are like, oh, I hate sex scenes in my movies. I'm just like, I don't want it to like feel cliched, and I think that would have been something that would have been like, of course. And like, they don't know each other. I think they know each other on like a first name only, although he just calls her Nash. I'm like, I don't know what kind of name
she
that
introduced
is.
Herself as Nash. So,
but yeah, it's interesting that they don't do that, but I'm glad they don't too. So,
another very interesting thing that was originally in the script that they cut was towards the end. When Howell shakes Howard's hand and spits in his face. In the original script, Howell gave Howard a lockpick during the handshake.
I'm glad they didn't do that.
To set up their showdown, like it was, I'm going to kill you, that's the only way I'm going to be able to stop you. Here's a lockpick so you can escape, basically.
I get the idea to give him a little more agency there, but I think the idea that he sees him as a threat that only he realizes is better. But like, you guys have no idea how dangerous this guy is, and he takes charge of the situation. I think that works better than if he would have been the one who did that. Plus, he would have been directly responsible for the deaths of all those cops on the, the transport bus then, if he would have been.
There's another interesting thing from the audio commentary is there were some producers, some higher ups, who wanted after the double barrel roll to have the cops crawl out of the cars.
Oh, just to know they're okay.
Yeah, because those are deaths that they sort of are responsible for.
Like, so much of the movie works on its ambiguity, so I disagree with that producer immensely. I assume that they're dead because everybody that he comes in contact with dies.
Yeah.
But you don't know, and that's one of the things that's great. I love the fact that the movie never beats you over the head with anything. It's always, I don't know. I don't know. That's why, like, that scene where he goes out and he points the gun up at his chin there. You're like, there's no dialogue. It's great. Like, he does this thing that I love. It's a great choice where he kind of, like, points the gun off in the distance and he, like, laughs. And then he just kind of sticks it under his mouth. And you're like, wow. Like, it's a dark, fantastic moment. But that's a choice. It's a great choice. And to say, oh, you know what would be better is if he started talking and going, no, not yet, not today. can you already see, like, any way he started talking, you would have been like, that fucking sucks now.
Yeah.
So allowing the ambiguity, allowing the audience, like, respecting the audience's intelligence, which this movie does all the time, is great. And again, another scene that's great, speaking of the Jennifer Jason Leigh stuff, is when she is tied between the trucks before it's revealed that that's what's going on, and he's walking between the trucks looking, and then the cops grab him. Like, you have no fucking idea what's going to happen in this movie. Like, that's like a
no.
What? And then you're like, what's going on? They're not cuffing him, and he's like, we need your help. You're like, what? And then, like, that is just like, holy shit. And again, you're like, well, he's going to be able to stop him, right? But no, because the movie is constantly saying, you have no idea what we're going to do. Yeah. And it's great because of that.
That was the point where I was like, okay, so he's definitely not in his head.
Yeah, that entire scene, aside from the fact that they do allow it to be super gory in the remake, even though it's like, what, like a 1 second shot of the guy getting ripped in half. But again, it's like just putting it in our heads that anything can fucking happen here, and then forcing our minds to like create the gore, which is probably what people, when they're saying it's gory, they're like, and they're offended. It's because their own brains came up with something way worse than they could have come up with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't listened to the audio commentary for this film, but did they bring up anything about, like, this being inspired by Steven Spielberg's Duel at all? Because that's what it felt like to me. It felt like Duel for the 1980s, no, with, like, a helicopter exploding and more violence and more car chase action. That's kind of what it felt like to me. It kind of felt like a Duel movie, except more pumped up and over the top. And that's a good thing to me, but that's just kind of how it felt to me at times.
No, I don't think they mention any other films at all, actually.
I'm glad you brought that up, though. I think Duel would be a great double feature with this. If you wanted to make a triple feature, I'd throw it with another movie that Eric Red wrote, which is Near Dark.
I've not seen that one.
It's excellent.
I have not seen Duel.
Duel's fantastic.
I'm expecting it to sort of be like a classy version of Joyride.
Yeah, I would compare it to Joyride. There's a whole psychological aspect of this movie that we've touched on several times already that is definitely there in Duel. And yeah, I don't even want to explain it because I kind of give it away, but you should definitely watch Duel and you'll get a lot of the same vibes. It's another one where you're just like, what is this force that our protagonist is up against? You're just going, what is going on the whole movie? And it's fantastic. Yeah, definitely watch it.
Now, where Eric Red claims the idea actually came from was the Doors song, Riders in the Storm.
Riders on the Storm.
Which makes sense.
Riders on the Storm, yeah.
Because that's a very cinematic song. It brings out a lot of emotions and has a lot of imagery that makes you want to like watch a movie based on it. And I guess they did make a movie based on it, The Hitcher.
It's Rider on the Road. I watched this.
Rocker on the Road.
Yeah. I watched this with my wife, and she was like, Rider. His name's Rider. It's a little on the nose. I was like, yeah, I think that's the point.
Yeah. And then again, in the remake, they're like, no, he stole somebody else's identity. There's actually somebody else called John Rider. Like, oh, Jesus Christ, just fuck off.
I know. Sometimes the dialogue can explain too much. It's like, don't do it. But it's a movie that doesn't really respect the audience. There's one thing that I like in the remake quite a
bit.
And
that's the skirt that Sophia Bush wears.
Yeah. No. No, it's, I think he asks to use her phone or something. And he grabs it and snaps it in half. And I was like, oh, that's such a great, like, moment of, like, oh, shit. This is, like, and I was like, that's the one thing that I liked, because I felt that moment when I was watching it in the theaters, and I went, oh, shit, that fucking guy. Like, if that happened to you in your car, the guy next to you that you just picked up just grabbed your phone and snaps it in half, you'd be like, oh, fuck, I'm probably going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't live without my phone, man.
Yeah. I was like, nah, I can't watch TikTok videos the rest of this ride. Yeah, that's definitely where I was going with that. No. I don't recommend watching the remake very much. It kind of bums me out that it exists, but that's how I feel about everything Platinum Dunes put out. That said, I guess if you want to bring up the sequel...
I still have so many notes from the audio commentary left.
Oh, go ahead, because I've not heard the audio commentary, and I would love to learn a little bit more.
Yeah, so this movie takes place in Texas. Where do you guys think it was shot?
Oh, I thought it took place in like Southern California or something.
No.
I have no idea. Is it Texas?
I mean, everybody does have that accent, so that's fair.
They shot it in 3 different states.
Oh.
Arizona, California, and Nevada, and it's set in Texas.
Okay.
Yeah, they shot some in near Barstow, California, Valley of Fire near Las Vegas. The barn that Halsey and Ryder meet in was in the Death Valley. So, yeah, all over, really.
Okay.
But not in Texas.
Not in Texas.
Well, the rocky outcrops and things that you see around and the hills, I don't associate with Texas.
Yeah, I have no idea about any of this. I'm like, sure, Texas, I'll buy it.
Same thing here.
So that's why I was curious what you guys made of it.
Yeah, I could see it being, like, for me, you know, I was looking at it and I went, hey, it looks like California to me. So
yes, a lot of it was.
But you may, you know, I guess I'll allow it to be Texas.
Yeah, it's acceptable. It's like,
so when I watch some movies, I'm very familiar with Montana. But every time I'm watching a movie that's supposed to be set in Montana, I'm pretty critical. So I'll be like, that's not Montana.
All those movies set in Montana. There's thousands of them.
A lot more than you expect.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay.
But I'd be like watching, I remember in particular, I was watching the movie Clay Pigeons. And there was one scene where they actually go out and they're shooting clay pigeons. And I was like, that kind of looks like Montana. But everything else, I was like, they're in a desert somewhere. And I'm like, this is not Montana. I was like, I'm sitting there talking to my friend who was watching with. I was like, what the? I was like, where is this shot? And at the end of the movie, it was like, filmed in Utah. I was like, yeah, okay. Eastern Montana has like desert area. They call it the Badlands. But it doesn't really look like Utah. Utah is pretty specific looking.
So near the start, they get stopped by a construction crew.
Mm-hmm.
When Howard puts his knife and his hand in Howell's crotch.
His switchblade.
And then the construction guy thinks they're gay.
Yeah.
That was originally written as taking place at a toll booth. But there are no toll booths anywhere in Texas. So they had to change it.
That's attention to detail.
That's an Illinois thing.
Yeah, we always have our toll booths in Illinois.
Yeah.
Big coming to take our money.
That's what Eric Redd, the screenwriter, says. And then Robert Harmon, the director, says, I think the construction site was just a lot cheaper. That's why it changed. But yeah, there's also only one build set in the entire movie.
What's that?
Everything is a real location except for the bus toilet.
Really?
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Because you would not be able to get a camera into one of those. Well, you could now. And they still... Just being on phone, but...
Yeah, and they deliberately still shot it very cramped, very close, because otherwise it wouldn't feel like an actual tiny bus toilet.
I noticed one shot, which, like, most of the movie, and this is something that I like about a lot of older movies, that they don't do a lot of what I call impossible shots. Where, yeah, like, the camera moves in a place where you're like, you could not put a camera there. And most of the movie is like that. There's one impossible shot, which they clearly just moved furniture around to do. But it's when he gets into the jail cell and he lays down and he goes to sleep. The camera is in the wall. And you're like, you would not, you know, that's not a real shot. But they just probably moved the bunk bed out and moved the camera back there. But in the other angle, the bunk bed is all the way against the wall. Which is like a dumb detail that I'm always looking at, like, camera work and stuff. But that one, I was like, oh, it's one of the impossible shot of the movie.
Yeah, another thing that was changed from the script was the character Esterich was originally called Esterhaz. But they changed it because there was a screenwriter with the same name.
Yeah, our good buddy from Basic Instinct and Showgirls.
Yes, and all the other sleazy 90s stuff.
I didn't know he was still... he was operating in the 80s. I don't even know what he wrote back then.
Yeah, I didn't either. But maybe we're just assuming it's Joe. Maybe it was another one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and there was 2 lines and 1 action that Howard improvised. And I think that's pretty much the only thing that he added. on top of the script, really. And the first one is when the cop asks him, "Where are you from?" And he answers, "Disneyland." The other one is in the car at the start when he says to Tommy Howell, "Crying isn't gonna help." And then towards the end, just before he gets shot, he throws the chains towards Tommy. And that's another improvised moment.
That's a cool moment, too. Because yeah. I still don't know what that means.
No, it's like, I'm free now, but he's dying. Like, or here are the shackles for you. Yeah.
I think the idea might be like, go ahead, chain me up again. See if I don't get out.
Oh,
and he's like,
might also, yeah.
He's like, no, I'm just going to fucking blow you away. Again, the ending is ambiguous as to, until you watch the sequel, you're like, what's this guy's life now? Because like, it's like, this is a crazy ass thing that happened to him.
Yeah.
This would be interesting, like the world that this exists in. You like, how does the media cover this story?
No, man. Yeah. 2 dozen people die in a hitchhiker incident.
Yeah, they'd be like, definitely, like, hitchhiking would just be outlawed across the world for this. This is like, it'll never happen again.
In the sequel, we do see a road sign that says, "Do not pick up hitchhikers."
Yes.
Yeah.
So that does make sense, yeah.
I have a hard time believing that that guy ever just, you know, didn't take anything but public transport ever again. You know? Like, no, thanks, I'll take the bus. No, I'll take a plane. Nope. Yeah, the airport's right there, you can just drive there. No, I threw away my license years ago. I don't drive anymore.
And actually, in the ending scene, they used live ammunition to shoot up the cop car.
Oh my God.
Obviously, without Tommy Howell inside, Squibbs weren't doing it, so they used live ammunition.
That's cool.
Yeah, I like those touches.
It is.
Not cool when you realize, again, what happened to Brandon Lee. But one of the last things you want is a live gun on a set. But it's still...
You're shooting at a car, nobody inside.
Well, I mean, the ending shot, by the way, I guess I should bring that up because I love it. I love that they do the thing that I never see enough of, which is the end credits are playing over a filmed sequence.
Yeah.
And it's just him. It's like he's reflecting on the day's events. And I fucking love it. It's shot in silhouette against this, like a sunset. And there's a moment where I thought, like, did it freeze frame? And then you see the match light up. He lights a cigarette. I was like, yeah, that's cool shit.
Yeah.
Again, it's cool without trying to be cool, you know? It's like, not my whole issue, but it's a good deal my issue with the remake. You're like, oh, man, you know what's cool, and you're just doing that. And that fucking bothers me. Like, yeah, Nine Inch Nails is cool, but you don't gotta play it over this sequence. It's already cool. It's like too much. But yeah, the ending shot is great. Any other fun things you've gleaned from the commentary?
Howard did his own driving.
All of it?
They say all of it, but like, I am assuming that when the Trans Am smashes the other car, I don't think that's him. But when he's shooting at the helicopter, even in a wide shot, that's actually him.
Well, there's plenty of shots where I can tell he's driving, but there's like a whole stunt where he breaks out of the garage and he runs over the pumps.
They say on the commentary that he does his own stunt driving, but I like that might be just a bit of an exaggeration on this on the part of the filmmakers.
Because I was like, that's a crazy stunt to let your actor do. He's like, I'm going to drive through a building and run over gas pumps.
Yeah.
Okay.
Reminded me of Halloween 4.
Yeah.
This is the second time we've brought up Halloween 4.
He's a Dwight Little Love, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? Halloween 4 is a very underrated sequel. It's the best of the sequels, if you ask me.
Ooh.
Low bar, but yeah.
It's really well done. And yeah, it's the best sequel in a franchise full of sequels that should not exist.
You liked it more than Halloween Resurrection?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, you can't do that.
I'm sorry, man.
No. The Busta Kung Rhymes.
Fu, the Kung Fu Busta Rhymes is just not enough to pull it through for me.
Oh man, I love Halloween.
Trick or treat, motherfucker.
Electroshocks, his gonads with like the wiring. It's just too good to resist.
I hate all of those sequels so much. But I think 4, it's like very well made. There's like craft to it, so I appreciate it. There are things that I like in Halloween 2, I guess I should admit. Yeah. But in general, like that should not have ever been a franchise. I would have been very happy with the world if there was only one Halloween film and it was Rob Zombies.
No, don't go there.
I'm such a freaking snob, man. I try not to be, but I'm talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre and, you know, I'm so anti-remake. It's rare for me to like a remake because most of the time I am like, why'd you do this? Why?
Good job tying it back to The Hitcher. We have gone on down the rabbit hole really fast. Like, oh, The Thing is great though, but we have to tie it back to The Hitcher.
There's only the scenes where they're driving in the dark are using rear projection. All the other ones are actually shot while moving.
Okay. It's kind of like Duel in that regard that like they used a lot of like in-camera driving effects, I guess.
Yeah. And John Seale talks about, for the look of the film, that he used something called gradient filters, which gradually darken or lighten the frame to create a sense of darkness around them, around the characters, and a sense of foreboding in the mountains, because the mountains were darker than the desert. He talks about using a lot of long lenses, especially while they're in the cars, to make it seem like the background goes by faster.
Yeah, I can tell actually in a couple of the scenes, and only because they do a thing where they show his speedometer going up to like 100 miles an hour, and I was like, he's not going that fast.
No. And then I like for the sequel, they were like, oh, it's in the desert, we better put an orange filter over it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that's going to hit you hardest when you get to the sequel. You're like, well, way different DP on this.
Yeah. We can partially blame the budget, I reckon.
Yeah.
Though, of course, everybody on all the audio commentary tracks were complaining that the budget was so small on the first one. I've never listened to a filmmaker go, yeah, we had plenty of money, plenty of time. Seems like whatever budget they're given, it's always too little.
Yep.
But yeah, the sequel.
All right. I like the sequel. It's good schlock. It's not as good as the first one, but if you just want to watch Jake Busey kill like a bunch of people, it's pretty good entertainment.
I love a bad horror sequel, and I think The Hitcher 2 is just a trash version of The Hitcher in like a good way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I can tell Brenton does not agree with us.
Well, you know, I have my own biases. I watched that movie, and at the time I was I'm like a snacker when I'm watching movies, and I was just going to town on some grapes, but I was like, grapes taste kind of like weird. And I remember turn on the light and my grapes were just completely molded over. Ugh. And so everything associated with that moment, which was I was watching Hitcher 2, I'm so like in my life, I don't eat them anymore because of that. You know, this everything ruined at that moment. So I have nothing but negative associations now with that movie because of the food I was eating.
But I enjoyed it. I mean, Jake Busey, he's a convincing psycho. I mean, he's related to Gary Busey, of course, which makes it very apparent that there's something off about his way he acts, you know. So it's good to have Jake Busey in the movie. And a lot of violence, some of it pretty graphic, more graphic than the first film. There's a lot of cheesy things that make you say, okay, this is just a piece of shit, but I enjoy it for what it is. Like, there's a chase between, like a semi and, like, an airplane. It's just so dumb, but I enjoyed it. It's fast-paced, stupid fun.
It's a trash version of the first one.
Yeah, and it has, like, the least exciting action scene of, like, all time. Like, Jake Busey takes, like, some car that he just murdered the owner of. He, like, puts it in neutral. And then at, like, half a mile per hour, it, like, slowly drives off the road into, like, a barbed wire fence. And you're just like, why did they keep this in the movie? This is horrible.
Yeah.
But I love it for that reason. Well, I don't love it. I do not love it. For the record, I do not love this film. But I do enjoy it.
Yeah, the thing I like about Jake Busey is there has never been so clear a case of a son inheriting his father's teeth. And it's so clearly a son.
Yes.
Well, I think he's an interesting actor because he just is like, well, I'm going to, you know, I look a certain way and I am going to allow myself to be typecast because of this. So he just like leans all the way into it. He's like, I'm a crazy guy in every movie.
Yes.
In Starship Troopers, they let him be a little bit more of a goofball. But in general, they're like, yeah, he's the crazy guy.
Just like his dad.
Yeah. Well, he just, it's almost like an opposite version of the first film, because the first film allows there to be ambiguity, allows you to think. And the thing about Hitcher 2 is it's like, it just hits you over the head all the time with what it is. Like, yeah, it's fucking violent. Yeah, he's fucking crazy. Yeah, you know.
I was a little surprised by the opening, though. Like, when the winner of Iowa's Jeffrey Lewis lookalike contest is, like, driving with a little kid. I thought he was, like, his grandpa. And then it turns out, like, he's, like, a kidnapper. And I was surprised by that. And I was like, oh, maybe this is going to be worthwhile watching.
That scene, that's how you start a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? Because we're all thinking like, oh, at the end of The Hitcher, did he become crazy? Did he become a psycho murderer? And then the sequel goes, well, he did. Oh, no, wait, he didn't.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they immediately just go like, it's a sequel, so it has to be bigger. So they're immediately like, we had cars in the first one. This time, we have planes.
Yes.
Well, DTV, what are you going to do?
Yeah, they play chicken with an airplane and a semi truck. It's not it's not exactly Citizen Kane, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, me too.
Well, they do allow for more explosions, so
yes,
even if they're terribly CGI explosions.
I was just gonna get to that—the god awful explosion where Jake Busey dies at the end.
It's such a cool moment. It almost worked.
Almost. It's basically him being tied up and ripped apart, except he doesn't get tied up. He just gets ripped to shreds by an explosion. You see, like, flaming body parts land here and there. There's a geyser of CGI blood. You get what you want to see. I mean, well, if you want to see CGI bullshit.
Yeah. But this is also just a movie that does what the remake tried better with the whole gender swap aspect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like, again, it plays with expectations by bringing back C. Thomas Howell and then killing him off about like half an hour in.
Well, honestly, that's the only thing I liked, because they're like, well, we'll make you think that it's going to be about him again.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, there's people out there that are just angry whenever the female lead takes over the reins of anything. Mm-hmm. But I...
Yeah, fuck them.
Because the first movie is constantly subverting your expectations. Or not even subverting them, because it's like you don't even know. You have no clue which scene's going to go where. I liked the aspect of going, it's going to be about him. You know, no, it's not. The thing that I don't like is that once he's out of the picture, you know exactly what's going to happen. You're like, okay, and then, you know, she's going to kill him. And you're like, hopefully it's cool. And you're like, toss up. Mm-mm. Good idea, bad effects. Which is it's a shame, because so much of the first film is practical. It's done, you know, for real. They did a great job with the stunts. And this one is like, they don't have the crew, the budget. So maybe they should have bothered. I don't know.
But the heart is there. Well, no, it's not. But it still works for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not terrible. Could have been better. But what's that guy directed it? That's what he does.
Louis Morneau?
Yeah. That's his whole thing. Like, his what he's become known for. His shitty sequels. So you're like, awesome. Although he's the guy that did the Fantastic Bats. Yeah. It's just like, it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. But it has this line that I always remember. Because there's tons of movies at the time that were like this, where they were like, oh, there's a killer version of some animal. And, you know, it was like, there were science projects. You know, it's like a Piranha. It's a ripoff of Piranha, which is a ripoff of Jaws. But in Piranha, it's like, nope, there were science experiments. And now they're out in the wild. And that's what Bats is. But they have this great line where he's explaining he made them more dangerous, and they're like, why? And he goes, we're scientists. It's just like, and that's just one of the fucking funniest things I've ever heard in a movie, so that's why I appreciate Bats.
That sounds like a line written for Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
But I even kind of enjoy the musical score to Hitcher 2. It kind of reminded me of, like, Michael Giacchino's musical score for the Batman, almost. Like, the dun, 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 dun. It's a very similar melody, but the first few notes are the same. Then it goes off in like some other direction that's not as good as the Batman's musical score, but whatever. It reminded me of the Batman, so that's a plus, I guess, even though it's not a great plus, but I enjoyed this film a little bit.
It's a Joe Kramer, man. He's done a bunch of good stuff.
Yeah.
So he's just better than the movie he was hired to score.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad, though, that they dropped the orange filter at some point. That they only keep it for the desert scenes. Because that shit was annoying.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a big fan of when they use the filter to begin with, like these big over-the-top color filters. But what are you going to do? It's kind of like, you know, anytime, it's the meme. Anytime somebody goes to Mexico, you got to use like the orange filter. Because that's what Mexico is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Steven Soderbergh.
Traffic? Was that the first one?
That's the one that comes to mind whenever someone brings that up. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember when they did that. You walk across the border and you're like, ooh, we got to squint.
Kind of reminds me of how like they made Uruguay in the Steven Seagal film Submerged. They turned it into like some like Mexican style Central American like, tropical paradise or whatever, even though that's not what Uruguay is. Just, well, it's in Latin America, so it's got to have palm trees, right? Got to have the filter.
The sequel does sort of like do away with all the ambiguity. It's just like, yeah, no, this guy's here, this guy's real. No, he doesn't want to fuck anybody. Which I think is actually a good move.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to see the exact same thing done again.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Don't know how I feel quite yet about the implication that John Ryder is like a being that can exist in multiple people, or several people.
Yeah. Well,
again, it's not a terrible idea, honestly. I just think that when you start implying things directly, it takes away that ambiguity that made the first one good.
Yeah.
Because the first one is really a little, The Hitcher is kind of a ghost story. And that's what I like about it. But it's like ambiguously a ghost story. And if you take away that, you're like, what do you got? Now you're like, oh, we're firmly in supernatural. Ugh.
I guess they were just looking for a way to explain how it happened again.
Yeah.
Like how
the same shit happened to the same guy twice.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
He should have actually said that.
Yeah.
The movie should have just been him, not again. Gets arrested. The guy's like, spit on my wrist. Like, oh my God, really? And Jennifer Jason Leigh shows up.
Again. In two pieces.
What? Yeah. Just on a wheelchair. Just like the top half just rolling around. Yeah.
Well, they did it with Darth Maul, so.
Yeah. Give her spider legs and I'll be like, oh, that's awesome. It's a whole different kind of movie now.
Oh, we're going to the science fiction territory. Yeah. And I like it.
But yeah, The Hitcher. Everyone should go see it.
If you like schlock, watch The Hitcher 2, I've Been Waiting.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you like punishing yourself, watch the remake.
Yeah. I love you, Sean Bean. You're great. I wish that you weren't in that. You're better than that.
No, he is good in the movie, but just it's the wrong character for the movie.
Well, I think, again, when you gender swap the lead, they should have gender swapped The Hitcher then, too.
Ooh.
I don't know.
No, I'm pretty sure that movie exists somewhere.
Yeah. The Chick Hitcher.
The Chick Hitcher.
You have to pick her up in a fake taxi. No, wait.
I think The Bitcher is just the dude that bitches about remakes. I think that's me.
You are the bitcher.
Yeah.
The Hitcher and the Bitcher.
Yeah. But yeah, highly recommend. A cool way to kick off spooky season, we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the...
Even though sometimes these films don't get classified as horror movies sometimes, which kind of surprises me because they are horror movies, but some people just say, oh, they're thrillers, as if there's like some sort of stigma around the word horror movie.
Yeah. Like if you start getting like technical about it, you're like, what do we call this movie? Because it is specifically weird, but...
Yeah.
I think it's one of the most underrated movies of the 80s, so I don't care what genre it is. This is one of those great movies to like watch late at night or early in the morning, whatever, just like pick it up. And like the vibes of it are so immaculate that it's gonna impress you. Yeah. I think especially if you love some good stunts.
Oh man, the scene of Rutger Hauer jumping through the windshield in slow motion, that lives in my head rent-free. So good.
With a lion roar.
Yeah. Sound. Well, it's another great, like, I don't know what he's going to do, and then you're just like, oh shit. Yeah, go check it out, even though we have spoiled the ending and the sequels. Sequel.
Yeah. Yes, they're both pretty good.
Loved it this time.
Yeah.
And agree with Brandon on the sequel. Good trash.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. I guess that's it for now. We should be back next week with the second Vampires and From Dusk Till Dawn episode. So yeah, follow the podcast if you want to listen to that one. Visit the website, alloutofbubblegum.com. Join the Discord. Maybe check out the Patreon. And we'll see you next time.
All right. See you then.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like